One fact has pretty much been established, and that is we're all going to die. Cheery news, I know, but might as well face the facts. We're all going to die. Short of Jesus coming again, everybody in this room is going to die. I'm not sounding this as a warning that it's any time in the next few moments, but the reality is it'll happen for each one of us, as it does every human being on this planet. We know that. Some of us spend a lot of time avoiding that thought or topic because it's not pleasant to us. Some of us spend a lot of time trying to delay it as long as possible with diets and exercise and vitamins and supplements and doctors and all kinds of other things. We just want to push out as far as we can, and that's fine, and that's good, and that's natural. And a lot of us spend a lot of time worrying about that and what it'll be like and how I'll feel and will it be painful and what's next after all of that. And we end up never really living because we are only ever thinking about dying. But there's one thing that I don't find a whole lot of people thinking about. One question I don't find a lot of people asking about death. And that is, will I do it well? Will I die well? We're all going to do it. How will we do it? Well, will I do it well? So we come to the end of chapter 47 and on the rest of the chapters ahead of us here. In Genesis, we find that Jacob is dying. Jacob is dying. It is perhaps, one of the most anticipated and drawn out deaths in all the Bible. Ever since chapter 37, Jacob's been talking about he's going to die. And others chime in at times and say, you know, we can't do this or we can't have that happen because it'll kill him. Yeah, and so you just keep hearing about Jacob's death. It's in chapter 37, 42, 43, 44, 45, chapter 46, and then here in chapter 47 and 48, it's very much at the fore. I don't know, sometimes you almost get the feeling along the way Jacob's so caught up in the fact that, you know, I just might as well die, I think I'm going to die, that he's, you know, maybe a little bit like Fred Sanford used to be in the old show Sanford and Son, if you're old enough to remember that. When Lamont would do something that Fred didn't like, he would grab his chest and stagger a little bit and say, oh, it's the big one, I'm coming, Elizabeth! You know? And Lamont would roll his eyes and know it was a manipulative effort to get what he wanted. I don't know that it was always that way with Jacob, but he does talk about it a lot, and so do other people. So we, like Jacob, are dying. Don't know how close it is for any of us, how imminent it is upon us. Just had my I've never yet figured out quite how to describe the relationship. Julie's sister's husband's brother-in-law twice removed by marriage or something, I don't know. Anyway, 39 years old, massive heart attack, father of three, in coma for a couple of days, several days. And, you know, it strikes it, and praise be to God, we prayed on Wednesday night here, as many, many others prayed many other places, and it appears, is recovering at least remarkably, if not completely. I mean, just a flat-out miracle. But it reminds you that at any given point, any one of us can go. So some of our deaths are closer than others. Some of us are more aware of that than others. But the question remains, will we do it well? So for starters, I want you to simply note that Jacob is dying well. I mean, he's talked a lot about it, but he's come to a place in his life where he's dying well. I mean, he really demonstrates that for us. And I want you, as I begin to read now in chapter 47, verse 28, down to the end of that chapter, just note the things that make for dying well. Verse 28, chapter 47. Jacob lived in Egypt 17 years. That's interesting because Joseph lived with him for the first 17 years of his life. Now Jacob lives with Joseph, at least in Egypt, for the last 17 years of his life. Nice, beautiful symmetry to that. And the years of his life were 147. When the time drew near for Israel to die, he called for his son Joseph and said to him, if I have found favor in your eyes, put your hand under my thigh and promise that you will show me kindness and faithfulness. Do not bury me in Egypt, but when I rest with my fathers, carry me out of Egypt and bury me where they are buried. I will do as you say, he said. Swear to me, he said. Then Joseph swore to him, and Israel worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. Three things I see there about dying well. When we die well, when dying is an act of hope. when it's an act of hope. Did you notice in verse 30 what he says? When I rest with my fathers, carry me out and bury me. Now look at that very carefully. Don't squeeze it all together and just say, well, that's all saying the same thing. Because it's not. It's two different things. When I rest with my fathers, carry me out and bury me. Two separate things. Resting with his fathers, that is Abraham and Isaac, who died in faith in God, who made covenant with them and established this redemptive purpose that would culminate in Jesus coming and suffering and dying and burying our sins, their sins, our sins, and paying for them, rising again from the dead, giving eternal life, sending out his people to proclaim this message of life to all the peoples of the earth. He would rest with his fathers. He's going to die in Egypt. He's going to rest with his fathers at that time. And then he says, carry me out, carry me back, get me back to Canaan, and bury me. Resting with the fathers, physically buried. Two different things. Jacob believed that Abraham and Isaac were already at rest. Not only were they buried physically, but they were at rest in the presence of God. And that he would join them when he died. We have a picture that Jesus gives us of this in the Gospel of Luke chapter 16 in the New Testament, when he tells the story of a rich man and Lazarus. Lazarus, a poor man, beggar man all his life, rich man, has everything he wants in this life. Lazarus dies, and it says in Luke 16 that the angels carried him to Abraham's side. Rich man awakened after his death in a fiery place of torment. But the poor man, the angels carried him to Abraham's side. Abraham is in the presence of God at rest. And those who die in faith go and rest with him. Even back at this time, before Christ died and rose again from the dead. Now, Jacob's body being buried with his fathers was only a symbolic expression of what he knew would have already taken place the moment he died. And that is that he would be at rest with them in God's presence. The New Testament says it in other terms, like Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5:18, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. Paul in chapter 1 of Philippians says he wished that he could depart, that is, this life, this body, this earthly existence with all of its fetters to this life, and be in the presence of Christ. The psalmist in Psalm 73, verse 24 says, you guide me with your counsel, that's this life. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward, you take me into your glory. So Jacob could die well because death for him was not so much an escape from this life's problems, although it would be that, but it was an entrance into the Lord's presence. And so dying well is done when it is an act of hope. Secondly, I want you to notice that we die well when dying is an act of faith. It's an act of faith. While his spirit would go and his soul would be at rest with Abraham and Isaac in the presence of God, Jacob was concerned about his body and where it would be buried. And so he wanted to be planted in Canaan, not in Egypt where they were right now. Why? Because it was in the land of Canaan that it was the focal point of all the promises that God had made to his fathers and put in motion this redemptive purpose that would end up being spread across the whole of the globe. But in their stage of the development of that, this family had to become one great nation from which the Savior could come. So that was going to happen in Canaan. And he wanted his body on location where those promises were going to be kept and fulfilled. Now, you might think to yourself, well, if you're already in the presence of God and you're at rest with your fathers there and others of faith, what does it matter where your body is? Well, the last act we ever perform on this earth is to die. Not going to do much on this earth after that. That's pretty much the last thing we do. We die. And once we're dead and gone, we're not going to speak. You're not going to choose. You're not going to direct anyone. You're not going to influence anyone. You're not going to persuade anyone anymore in this world. Your death is pretty much the last thing you're going to do on this earth. And our last act is precisely the same as every other person's last act. We die. But do we do it well? What do you want to do with that last act, with death? Jacob said, as for me, I want my last act to a burial, to be a buying into the purposes and promises of God. They're going to be fulfilled on this earth. I want my last act, I want the last thing that is known about me to be planted where I know the promises of God are going to be fulfilled. Now, in this, he kind of makes me think of Jeremiah. That fast forwards quite a bit in the history of Israel. But Jeremiah 32 tells a very interesting story. Set the stage just a bit. Judah, the nation of Judah, has been invaded, overrun, and taken captive by the overwhelming Babylonian army. I mean, they have just come in by the hordes and they have just taken over the entire nation. And now they have besieged Jerusalem, the last stronghold, and they're starving out the people inside like a bunch of rats, including Jeremiah. Jeremiah, within the city walls of Jerusalem, is actually in prison. And because he's been telling everybody that this is exactly what's going to happen, that God is sending these Babylonian armies to defeat our nation, to destroy Jerusalem, to take us away in exile because of our sins, the sins that we've committed, the sins our fathers have committed, as an act of discipline, he's taken as unpatriotic and seditious. And so he's in prison. And if he desired it, he was about to have the biggest "I told you so" moment in the history of the world, because Jerusalem would fall. It did fall. And from all appearances and for all intents and purposes, the city, the nation, was about to die. And with it, apparently, from a human perspective, all the promises and purposes of God that result in salvation, this nation brings forth Jesus, that brings salvation, and so it was all from all horizontal appearances about to die and come to an end with the death of this nation and this city. And so what does Jeremiah do with his very last moments? He makes a real estate investment. He sends word and he purchases a field out in the Judean territories. Now, right now is a camp out location for the armies of Babylon, and he buys it. He buys a field in Anathoth. Why would you do that? Because if you do live through this famine and the siege and Archa, you might need that money more than you're going to need a piece of ground you're never going to see again. I love the way Eugene Peterson describes it. Listen, as he describes it from his book, Run with the Horses. He says, Jeremiah did what at the time appeared absolutely crazy. He bought a field for $17. It was crazy because the very moment that he was buying it, the Babylonian armies were camping on it. He himself was in prison with no prospects of getting out. The enemy was pounding the city walls and about to take the people off to exile. At that moment, Jeremiah bought a field on which he would never plant an olive tree, never prune a grapevine, never build a house, a field that in all probability he would never even see. Why did he do it? He did it because he was convinced that the troubles everyone was experiencing were at the very that very moment being used by God in what would eventually turn out to be the salvation of that land. He goes on to say, buying that field in Anathoth was a deliberate act of hope. All acts of hope expose themselves to ridicule because they seem impractical, failing to conform to visible reality. But in fact, they are the reality that is being constructed, but is not yet visible. Hope commits us to actions that connect with God's promises. That's exactly what Jacob was doing. In his last act, he dies and he instructs his son, you take my dead bones back to the land of promise. Oh, I'll be at rest in the Lord's presence with my father and grandfather and the others of faith. But I want my bones on location when those purposes prevail and God does what appears now could never be possible. He was buying into the fact that even death can't stop God's promises. It's almost as if he said, you know, I die, but the promises of God live on. With death, you lose all, you know. What do you control at death? Nothing. You go in, if you will, I don't know, how would you just see, you know, at death, you go into a free fall. Because there's just nothing you do that controls anything. But you know that the promises, the enduring, unchangeable promises of God resting on the solid bedrock of God's character and faithfulness will hold you at those moments. And he said, I want, though dead, my bones on location when those promises come true. So dying well, we die well when we die as an act of hope, we die as an act of faith, and then we die well when dying is an act of worship. Do you see verse 31? Look at that again. Swear to me, he said. And Joseph swore to him, and Israel worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. Now, depending on the Bible translation you got, it might say leaned on the top of his staff, or it might say he bowed his head bowed down at the head of his bed. It's a matter of a couple of things. The point is that this aged, dying, probably something of an invalid man, is doing the very best he can to prostrate himself before the Lord in worship. He's bowing down to God and saying, you know, you're God, and I'm not. And I'm really, really glad. You win. Jacob had wrestled with God most of his life. In fact, he'd wrestled with him literally at Peniel in Genesis chapter 32. And God won at Peniel. He won in all of Jacob's life. And death was Jacob's way of laying it down and saying, you win. You know, I've wrestled with you. I've wrestled with what you do. I've wrestled with your plan. I've wrestled with how it works out in my life. I've wrestled with what it means. I've wrestled with everybody and everything. But I want to say right now, I bow myself down to you with my dying breaths. And I say, you are God. I exalt you. I worship you. You win. And you know, death is our last act of worship. I don't know if you think about death that way, but death will be the last thing we ever do on this earth, and it ought to be our very last act of worship. It's an interesting thing that takes place in the New Testament. Twice, the Apostle Paul uses words that really say that same thing. Once, over in Philippians chapter 2, verse 17, he's imprisoned. He's in a Roman prison. It's his first Roman imprisonment. For all he knows, it's going to be his only Roman imprisonment. For all he knows, he's never going to get out. He may die there. Doesn't really know for sure. And so he makes reference to the possibility that he may just be pouring his life out like a drink offering. He doesn't know for sure, but there's a possibility that what I'm doing in this prison is I'm pouring my life out as a drink offering. And if you don't know the background, you think, what does that mean? Well, he was released from that imprisonment, apparently, and traveled and so forth, but he was rearrested, put in a much more difficult and dangerous Roman imprisonment. Much more trying circumstance, one from which apparently he never emerged, that he was martyred during that imprisonment. And his very last communication that we have written from that prison is 2 Timothy. And in chapter 4 and verse 6, now not just a possibility, now he knows. He said, I am already being poured out like a drink offering, and the time for my departure has come. What is he talking about? Well, in the Hebrew mind, for the Jewish people, the drink offering was often the very last act of worship after sacrifices were offered. Other sacrifices were made, other offerings were offered up to God. And the last thing that was done was to make a drink offering. Wine was poured out over or after all the other sacrifices had been. It was the crowning, final, last act of worship. And he's saying, death is our final act of worship. It can only be our last act of worship, our final act of worship, if there have been other acts of worship. Right? It shouldn't be our first act of worship. It should be our final crowning act of worship. Our whole life, our very life itself being poured out before God, unable to be gathered back up in this world, unable to be put back together, reassembled, put back in the wineskin, poured out in finality and lost, as it were, to God. The last act of death becomes just like all the other acts of life, and that is, they're given up to God as our reasonable service of worship. Isn't that what Paul says in Romans 12, 1 and 2? That in view of God's mercies in Jesus, who died and rose for us, in view of His mercies, he says what? Offer yourselves to God as living sacrifices. That's every single day, every moment of every day. I'm giving myself up to you, my time, my efforts, my talents, my treasures, my everything. I'm offering myself up to you again and again. I am a living sacrifice. It has to be continually offered up to you. Because of what Jesus has done, I continually give myself as a living sacrifice, which is my reasonable. It's the only logical, reasonable way to live in light of what God has done for us in Jesus. It's our reasonable service of worship. So, to die well is to die as an act of hope, to die as an act of faith, to die as an act of worship. So how can I die that way? Well, I really do believe there is a thing such known sometimes as dying grace, a grace that you only get. That you don't get it 6 months ahead of time. You don't get it 6 minutes ahead of time. You don't get it, you know, whatever. It's grace in the moment when you need it. It's a grace you'll only know. I really believe that's true. There's a dying grace. So how do I get that dying grace? Well, dying grace follows on the heels of daily grace. If I want to die by God's grace, it means I have to live by God's grace. So dying well requires living well. Now, don't misconstrue what that I'm saying with that. You might think, oh, well, I got to redouble my efforts, and I got to go out and I got to make sure I conform. I got to grab myself by the bootstrap, pull myself up, and I got to go out and clean my act up, and I got to live right. No. Let's let the text actually tell us. You know, somebody says, okay, to die well, I have to live well. I get that. I'm not going to be something in death that I haven't been in life. If my life has not been lived in hope, I'm not going to die in hope. If my life has not been lived in faith, I'm not going to die in faith. If my life has not been lived as worship, I'm not going to die in worship. Now, thank God, there's the thief on the cross whose life changes right before that, but it's evidence there. But you're not going to change all of that after death. If I want to die by God's grace, I have to live by God's grace. But what does it mean to live well? Well, I think that chapter 48 reveals something of that to us. It illustrates it more than anything else. We have this great story, as was read earlier, of Jacob knowing he's about to die, and so Joseph is brought in, and he brings with him his two sons, and there's this wonderful thing of adopting them as Jacob's own sons, and then his blessing of them along with the other sons that we're going to read about and study in chapter 49 in our next study, getting the blessing. It's a great picture, But as we look at Jacob and we think about who Jacob is, who he's been, what we've known about Jacob, and we see the way he is now, we realize that he's been changed. And he demonstrates to us here something of what it means to live well. Two statements I'm going to make, and I'm going to unpack them for you. The first is this, that living well requires not taking, but receiving. Living well requires not taking, but receiving. Jacob has been a taker all his life. He's been taking from the moment, well, before he was born. Literally. Chapter 25, Jacob is and Esau are born. And Esau comes out first. And what does it say? Jacob sticks his hand out of the womb and lays hold of his brother's heel and said, you're not getting ahead of me. In fact, Jacob means he who grasps the heel. Taking. Grabbing, seizing, demanding he's going to be in control. Not going to wait, not going to receive, he's going to take. So from the womb, he is a taker, he's a grabber, he's a grasper. He tricked Esau out of his birthright. He knew by God's revelation that he was going to be the one, but he had to take it. He had to seize it. He had to make it. He had to devise. He had to scheme. He had to plan. He had to figure out how to get it for himself. He tricked his father out of his blessing when it was going, apparently, to go to Esau. He took matters into his own hands and he manipulated his blind, aged father into blessing him. When he ran away to Paddan Aram, came under the care of his uncle Laban, he devised ways to take his flocks from him, multiply the certain sheep and goat would be his instead of his uncle's. And he connived and he manipulated. He had been a taker. He'd been taking all his life. He is a schemer, a trickster, a taker. And there's a little Jacob in all of us. By nature, we believe that life is based on blessing. Success is based upon taking. Taking, the difference between taking and receiving, what is it? It's a matter of control. Well, if I'm a taker, I got to seize control of things or I'm not going to get what I deserve. If I'm a receiver, I realize, you know, I have a Father in heaven who is good. He has spoken to me. He spoke to Jacob. He spoke to Isaac. They knew the plan. He's spoken to us. And He's good. And He never forsakes those who seek Him. And so I can receive His grace, His blessing. I don't have to try to seize it and take it. But by nature, we're takers. We're Jacobs. We're if you maybe use New Testament terminology, we're more bent, oriented toward works than grace. But somewhere along the line, this changed for Jacob. And he doesn't really elaborate on it here. We simply see it in a simple little statement he makes. I'm not going to read the whole of chapter 48, but look at chapter 48, verse 3. Jacob said to Joseph, okay, he's dying. He crystallized things, you know, these are important. Last words are important. So what's he going to say? God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan, and there He blessed me. Not there, I figured out a way to seize hold of the birthright and grab the blessing and, no, rob the flock, no. There He blessed me. Not because of the way I was, not because of something I'd done, but in spite of the way I was and who I was and what I was. Jacob, at that point in life, had pretty much destroyed his life and his family. In the world, by his taking, his seizing, his demanding, Esau wanted to kill him. His mother told the father, we got to get him out of here and we got to have him flee. And his taking had nearly destroyed his life and his parents and his family and the promise. But God came to him, chapter 28, and He gave to him the blessing. Something he was just able to receive. He couldn't take it. He had to receive it. He was asleep. He was vulnerable. He was in the middle of nowhere, in the dark, alone, sleeping. And God came to him and gave him the blessing, gave him the promise, gave him that redemptive line of purpose. It wasn't about outfoxing anybody. It wasn't about conniving, working, and earning. It really comes down to an issue of will. Who's going to be in charge? Do I have to seize and take, or can I open my hands and just receive? Because God's that good. It's like the drowning swimmer who if finally comes as a realization to them that if I seize, if I grasp, I'm going to die. But if I surrender myself and receive the help of the lifeguard, I'll be saved. God finally broke through to Jacob and broke him of his self-dependence and reduced him to the place of living by the blessing that would be given him. So living well is living by the grace that God gives. It's not about taking. It's not about earning. It's about receiving God's blessing, God's grace. He blessed me. But it's more than just that. Living well requires not taking, but receiving. But living well requires not just receiving, but giving. And that's what we see him doing here. the blessing he has received, verse 3, he now is conferring and passing on. Because Jacob's come to realize, you know, it's not about me. I'm called to be a conduit, not a cup. And so I've been blessed that I might pass that blessing on to others. And I want to do that at my very end. I want to do that with my family. I want to do that with Joseph and his son. He's just, the whole rest of the chapter is just about him passing on that blessing, that grace that he's received from God. And in doing so, with his dying breath, he says in verse 9, bring them, the two sons, to me so I may bless them. Verse 15 says, and he blessed Joseph. And verse 16 says, may he, God, bless these boys. In other words, he blessed me, and now I've learned that life is about receiving his grace and his blessing, and I want to pass that on and for them to receive it as well. Now, he does this in two specific ways. He does this giving, this passing on, in two specific ways. First, he adopts Joseph's two sons as his own. Verse 5 down through verse 12. And there's this elaborate adoption ceremony that you might not realize that's kind of what's going on, but there's a certain conformity to standard laws of the time for adopting these two boys who are Joseph's physical sons, but they would be counted as the sons of Jacob. They'd be counted among their uncles as full sons of Jacob. It begins with a declaration of intent. In verse 5, he talks about your two sons will be reckoned as mine. I am intending to adopt them and make them my own. Declaration of intent. Secondly, there's the identifying of the parties. Verse 8, he goes, who are these? And we think, well, he's a blind old man who doesn't know what's going on. He can't tell. But he knows. It's not that he doesn't know who they are. He's just named them by name. And he doesn't have that bad of a short-term memory problem. He's just simply saying, I want you to formally identify the two parties that are involved in this adoption. And so they're identified. Verse 9. They're placed on his knees, or probably beside his knees. They're probably 20 years old, and Jacob's not in the best of health. It's a little hard to see them actually sitting on his knees at this point. But they're at least symbolically by his knees as a symbolic act of, I suppose, almost being birthed as his very own symbolically. Verse 9, verse 12. Verse 10, there's the embrace and the kiss of acceptance. In verse 12 again, there is the consent of the father, Joseph, now bowing down. Isn't it interesting what was the original dreams that got him in trouble? Family, brothers, father would all bow down to him. And indeed, the whole world for Pharaoh was bowing down to him. But now this one before whom everybody had to bow except one person, that Pharaoh, now bows himself before Jacob. And he consents. He says, yes, the adoption will be legal. And this is all wonderful. But it's a blessing not so much to the boys. That's going to come in just a moment. It's a blessing to Joseph. For this means what? It means, you know, what's the birth order in Jacob's family? There's, you know, Reuben and Simeon and Levi and all these sons. And then Joseph. But Joseph is now being taken and brought to the head of the line and made number one son. First son, firstborn son, got double the inheritance of all the other sons. By adopting his two sons and placing them in equal standing with the other of Jacob's sons, he's saying, Joseph, you're considered number one son, and your double portion will go to these two boys of yours. So he's in the adoption, he's blessing Joseph and naming him to be his number one firstborn son. But the second thing he does is not just adopt the sons, he actually then blesses Ephraim and Manasseh. Verse 13 through 22 describes that. He's going to bless the rest of the sons in chapter 49, as we'll see in our next study. But he begins here with the number one son, Joseph, and he gives him a double portion, and he pours out his blessing upon these two boys, as we see there. So to die well, you have to live well. Dying grace comes to those who have learned to live by daily grace. And that is not by taking things on your terms, but receiving God's grace on his terms, and then becoming a conduit for that grace to go to other people, like Jacob is becoming here for these. Whether that's in our witness, on our way through life, whether it's the end of our lives and the blessing we bestow on those around, making life about receiving God's grace and passing it on to the next person around us. such a person can expect to offer up their death as an act of hope, an act of faith, and an act of worship. Now, we need to conclude. You might say, well, okay, I get it. It's 1 plus 1 equals 2, right? I mean, I just receive God's grace, and I keep passing God's grace along, and then I'm going to get an I will, right? I mean, it's 1 plus 1 equals 2. Well, yes and no. Because it's not a formula to work. Because aren't we just back to taking? If it's a formula to be worked on our terms, it's a gift to be received and passed on. God doesn't give His grace to us based on religious formulas. Too often we think so, and so, you know, we make church rules, and we do all these things, and we, you know, got all these things, and you got to do this, and if you do that, and you don't do that, and you make sure you don't do that, and you do this, then, you know. And we're back to being Jacob again. God's grace is not given according to religious formulas, but by His sovereign pleasure. He's in charge. We receive. And that troubles us. Because we like grace, but we don't like grace. We like to be saved by grace, but we don't want to have to live by grace. Because what if I don't like the way God deals things out in my life? Or somebody else's life? And we see that this troubling struggle with grace is exactly what happens to Joseph as his father's blessing his boys. Look at verse 13, chapter 48. Joseph took both of the two sons, put Ephraim on his right toward Israel's left hand because he's the younger, Manasseh on his left toward Israel's right hand because he's the older, and the right hand is the place of priority and, you know, greater blessing and authority and all of that. Special favor. And so he takes the older son and puts him to Israel's right hand and brought them close to him. But Israel reached out his right hand and put it on Ephraim's head, though he was the younger. And crossing his arms, he put his left hand on Manasseh's head, even though Manasseh was the firstborn. Verse 17. When Joseph saw his father placing his right hand on Ephraim's head, he was displeased. Literally, it was evil in his eyes. This is not right! So he took hold of his father's hand to move it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. I get all kinds of mental pictures about that. It's a bony old gray haired arm, you know, and trying to pry it off the kid's head. Verse 18, Joseph said to him, "No, my father, this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. I'm not as far gone as you think I am. He too will become a people, and he too will become great. Nevertheless, his younger brother will be greater than he, and his descendants will become a group of nations." And he blessed them that day. Why was Joseph troubled? He was delighted for grace when it came to him being shuffled back to the front and be called number one son. He loved grace for that. He didn't like grace when his younger son was blessed over his older son. And we like to be saved by grace. Living by grace is not so easy because God's grace, we don't receive it always the way we would dole it out. But we ought to know by now with this family that God has made His point all the way through Genesis that, you know what? I give my grace as I see fit, not as you direct. And so He chose Abel's sacrifice, the younger, over Cain, the older. And so He chose Isaac, the younger, over Ishmael, the older. And so He chose Jacob, the younger, over Esau, the older. And so He chose Joseph, the younger, not Reuben, the older, to be the firstborn. And in so doing, their mothers, He chose Rachel, the younger, to be exalted over Leah, the older. And Ephraim, right here, the younger, put over Manasseh, the older. And too often we're Cain, and we're Ishmael, and we're Esau, and we're Reuben, and we're Leah. And we say, "Wait a minute! That's not fair!" And we grumble about the way God distributes His grace. Now remember, it's not that they didn't have an opportunity to share in the grace of God and His salvation. It's a matter of how He doled it out in their process of living that out. Receiving it and passing it on. We play different roles. Different times with different people. And it's not distributed according to our rights, perceived rights, our efforts, our work, our human logic, our justice, our sense of what rules ought to apply. God does it as He sees fit. And everything we've got is by God's grace. Everything, including the capacity to be angry at Him for how He distributes His grace. Die well. We want to die in hope. We want to die in faith. We want to die as an act of worship. Well, dying well requires living well. And living well means that I receive the grace that God gives me. And I with gladness pass it on as He sees fit. That includes my station in life and how it goes and how my health is and how, my ministry goes. And all kinds of things. It involves all of that. And say, I want to live well. Receiving with gladness, passing along with joy, that I might die well. Now, last thing. Interesting. As you're in the Old Testament, always look back to Hebrews chapter 11 and see if there's some comment in Hebrews 11, the great hall of faith, about the person or the situation that's going on. And there is in this case. Hebrews 11, 21. Look at it up here on the screen. It says, "By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff." Look at that for just a second and figure see if you can find out what is unusual about that. "By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff." What's strange about that? When he was dying, he blessed and worshipped. When you're dying, your last possession, the last thing in your possession are things like heartbeats and brainwaves and breaths in your lungs. And those even are being taken from you. When you're dying, you have nothing. I mean, it's all being stripped away. What do you have left? What are you able to do when brainwaves and heartbeats and breaths are taken away? And you have, what else do you have left? When we are able to live by God's grace, it means that when everything is stripped from us, including brainwaves, heartbeats, and breaths, you still have something to give. A blessing to those around you. And worship to God. When the brainwaves cease, the breaths give way, and the heartbeats stop, the blessing of God goes on. I want to live in that, and I want to die in that. How about you?